Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Superman Sunday episode, and we're going to do something a little different. We're not going to focus on one particular issue this episode. We're going to be focusing on a whole era, and this is in anticipation of actually going through this era and focusing on each book, maybe two, three books an episode, but each book spotlighted on a particular episode. So it's the Superman Triangle era. I know a lot of you know what that is, and probably a lot of you don't, so we will explain it. But I have what I will call a Superman Triangle expert, Donnie Sparrow, joining me on the show. So welcome to the show, Donnie. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great.
So I always like to ask people when they're on the show for the first time to kind of give their history with comics. Like, how did you fall in love with the medium? Like, you know, what was the first book you read? How did you come to discover the wonderful world of comics?
Absolutely. Well, it's very much entwined with Superman. My dad used to bring home comics just for me to read, sort of how I learned to read. So it used to be sort of always just a gift, like he'd have a new comic for me. And but the first comic I bought with my own money, which is kind of where it, you know, I feel like it really started, was when I was six, was John Byrne's Man of Steel miniseries. So I was really a perfect jumping on point. I didn't know anything about the pre-crisis, so that's where it started. I've since obviously learned a lot more about the history of Superman and the characters and everything. But it really started there. So that was really my introduction to comics.
Yeah, and then you do some illustration too, right? Like you actually work in comics to some extent.
I do, yeah. So I do like freelance illustration, so editorial illustration in a comic booky style. So I've been in, you know, magazines and newspapers and album covers and that kind of thing. But I'm always sort of knocking on the door of real comics too. Real comics don't actually pay quite this good, but I would still drop everything to to do some real comics. So I've done a couple graphic novels, and I'm working on sort of a sci-fi one now. But obviously, if DC came knocking, I got a lot of ideas about Superman. So
awesome.
But, yeah.
Awesome. And for you listeners, the way I kind of discovered Donnie is him and his buddy Max do this blog. I know, you know, blog, whatever, it's kind of very 2000s, but I'm telling you, you know, you don't have to consume all your information via podcast or YouTube videos. There's something to be said for reading, right? I mean, reading comics, reading blogs, and it's this the Superman 86 to 99 blog, which I actually found a few years ago, being such a huge Superman fan. And you guys go through and you really examine a lot of the books of that era that are kind of in the wheelhouse for you and Max when you really fell in love with the character, right?
In extreme detail. I know that it can be kind of, it's a little too exhaustive maybe for like the uninitiated, but at the same time, it's a really good way to learn, you know, what was in these books. And I'm a kind of a newcomer to it too. Like Max did it for a couple of years before I jumped on, and I was just a fan. And I was always, you know, commenting and saying, oh, there's this thing, and, you know, and being obnoxious. And so finally he said, hey, why don't you just write? So my focus is more on the artwork end. He kind of does more plot summaries and like funny stuff. Obviously he's a very talented comedic writer. He works for cracked.com and a bunch of different things. But, so my focus is typically on the artwork or like weird details. Yeah, since I joined the posts have gotten probably unnecessarily long, but that's just how we like it. So,
yeah, I really recommend it to any of you guys that are Superman fans, big Superman fans, especially of that era. There's, for me, I've read a lot of that stuff when it first came out, but I haven't necessarily gone back and revisited it. And so for me, it's a nice trip down memory lane. And I usually pick up one or two things in the articles that I didn't notice, or maybe I had forgotten that I noticed. So there's a lot there for sure.
Thanks for reading it.
All right, well, let's get on to the main topic here. So the Triangle Era. I have people ask me sometimes, you know, what's the Triangle Era? I hear about Triangle Era. It can be kind of confusing. Like, why are there two numbers? So just to kind of give the explanation of what the Triangle Era is. So starting in January 1991, I believe with – I think it was Superman number 51 was the issue with Mr. Z on the cover. So starting with that issue, DC put a triangle on the cover, not necessarily near where the regular, you know, number was, the number 51, you know, Superman title, that, you know, more toward the bottom. And it was a little triangle, and it was inverted. So, you know, the long, flat part was on top and the point was at the bottom. And at the top, along that flat line, it said 1991 and tapered down to a point, and it had a number one in it. And then subsequent Superman books would have the same symbol, but the number would change. So 1991 2, 1991 3, and so on and so on and so on, all the way through January 2002. I can't remember the issue. I think it was, I want to say Action Comics 285.
Last one was, I think, this issue. Yeah, and they actually brought back, Jerry Ordway did a backup story on it, so it was very, very of its time, but it was, yeah, I mean, that's a really long run.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking 11-plus issues. So what it was a way for you, as a Superman reader, to be able to follow the storyline, right? I mean, a lot of us that read comics, especially during the 80s, when it was these continuing stories, these serialized stories, it would be at the bottom of the last page where it would, you'd get a little blurb saying story continues in, and it wouldn't, especially if it was a crossover, it wouldn't necessarily continue in the following month's title, right? So if, say, if it was a Fantastic Four Avengers crossover, it wouldn't say story to be continued in, you know, Fantastic Four and have the next issue number. It would say, you know, to get the next part of the story, go to Avengers, whatever, 255, and then come back next month for, you know, Fantastic Four 260 or whatever. So for the Superman titles, previous to this, the creative teams on the different books had been working pretty tightly together on continuity. And they gotten to the point where they said, you know what, let's have the storyline continue, the main storyline continue from one issue right to the next issue of the other title, and it would alternate back and forth. Because when it started, it was just Adventures of Superman and Action Comics. So it was a way where, as a reader, you wouldn't have to wait a whole month, right? You wouldn't have to wait for the next issue of Action. You could, you know, just wait a couple weeks and the Adventure would come out, you'd get the next part of the story. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, you'd have Action, you'd get the next part of the story. So that's what the Triangle era is. It's just an era where all the titles were very close together in continuity, and you didn't have to wait as long, because eventually what happened is they started the Man of Steel series. Oh, actually, I take that back. I guess there was three to start, because there was Action Comics, Adventures of Superman, and Superman. So you right. So you had three titles, three bit chunks of the story per month.
Right, which is why they had the triangle, but then they kept it a triangle even when they added the fourth comic. They didn't make it a square, but
right. Oh, I did not see. This is exactly why you're here, Don. I did not think about that. Yeah, so three sides, triangle, three titles. Right. So and it was also so you knew, especially if you weren't picking them up as they came out week to week, you knew what order to read them in because you had that triangle number. And then eventually they added the Superman, the Man of Steel title to bring it up to four. So you were getting Superman every week. And again, you had the triangle numbers on there, so you knew what order to read them in. And then, of course, being that every 3 months you had a month that had a fifth Wednesday, for a long time there was no Superman, so you'd get a skip week. Well, DC said, we can't have that. We've got to give our Superman fans a Superman story every week. So they came out with the Superman, the Man of Tomorrow series, which was quarterly. So it only came out four times a year. It came out just to fill that void. So you literally had a Superman, a chunk of Superman story, like every week. So Donnie, I wonder, were you actively buying comics when they started Superman comics when they started the Triangle era?
I was. I pretty much, from that first comic in 86, when John Byrne sort of rebooted Superman, they called the post-crisis Superman, I was just buying them all. So, I mean, it was before comic stores kind of hit my town. So I was just getting at the drugstore, and luckily for me, they had Superman comics. It's interesting that they started the triangle numbers with number 51, because they really had been pretty tightly linked a long time before that. Basically, kind of from when John Byrne left, really, is when the stories got really tightly linked, that each issue would follow the other very closely. To the point where people would be wearing the same outfits, you know, like it would be really, I can't imagine what effort must have gone in editorially to say, hey, no, look, you know, Jimmy's wearing this, you know, or these different details, but they kept it all very tight. But yes, I was reading them as they came out. And so the fun part of this blog is that I get to revisit these issues, a lot of which, you know, they're favorites of mine. So I've got to memorize. But then, like you say, it's good to look at them with fresh eyes and go, oh, you know, the stuff I get now that I didn't then.
So did you notice right away the triangle? Do you remember if you were like, wait, what's this triangle business all about?
I do, yeah, because they added the triangle, and I didn't sort of catch on that it was to what it was. I think they eventually addressed it in a letter column, and then I went, oh, of course that's what it is. I knew the order they came out in, right? So I would be like, okay, well, you know, this next week's action, and then after that, it's whatever. So, but it was a really neat way, and for filing as a comic collector, it's really great too, because then, you know, Superman uniquely, you can sort of file by storyline rather than by title, you know.
Yeah. So I, much like yourself, you know, had always been a pretty big fan of Superman. But I actually found myself pre-crisis not reading a lot of the books just because I was kind of DC's exact target audience. He was so powerful. He could do anything. To me, it was a little boring. As much as I loved Superman, you know, Christopher Reeve as Superman, seeing that when I think I was like 4 or 5 years old, that just left such an impact on me. And so I jumped on with the Man of Steel, John Byrne, loved it. You know, got bought all the books off the stands and was loving everything. I was disappointed when Byrne left, but I was still, you know, following along. I think the Superman Exile storyline, to your point about them being, you know, tightly, the continuity between titles being very, very tight. That's a perfect example right there. There weren't any triangles on the covers, but that you read that Exile storyline. I mean, one issue leads right into the following issue from a subsequent title. So. Mm-hmm. My thing was, because again, I didn't live in a town with a comics shop, so I was kind of at the mercy of, you know, what the local 7-Eleven had. And I think eventually I missed an issue here or there of one or other particular Superman title. And so I wouldn't read them. Like if I missed an issue, I would still keep buying them, but I wasn't reading them because I didn't want to, you know, miss out on part of the story.
So oh, that's funny.
I think once, yeah, just part of my type A personality. So I think once I had missed a few issues and I wasn't reading them, I just kind of fell away from Superman for a while. And then when I went away to college and then there, you know, I was in a much larger metropolitan area and there was a comic shop there. And I heard about the Death of Superman title coming up. I was like, oh, you know, what's this? They're going to kill Superman. No. So I started going to the shop and picking up a bunch of back issues and everything. And that's I noticed right away. I'm like, what's this triangle thing? So I did a little, you know, research on it and looked at it. And I was like, oh, so this is great. I've missed out on a lot of these books. It was probably like a 2-year period or so. From like 90 to mid 92, late 90 to mid 92 that I had missed out on these books. So for me, it was great. It was like, I know I can go and pick up these back issues and I'm going to know exactly what order to read them in because it has these numbers on the cover. And then, you know, I was hooked for ever since then. And I was actually kind of sad when they took them away, but I kind of understand why they did it. So yeah, for me, discovering that they were there was kind of a blessing in my mind because I knew exactly the order that I needed to read them in. So, but again, as I mentioned, there are some negative aspects, and as much as I enjoy the Triangle era because it does for me hold a lot of nostalgia, you know, college days and just a certain period of time of Superman and just completely rediscovering my love of comics. Yeah, it'll always hold kind of a special place for me. But again, I recognize that there are people that don't like it for various reasons. So Donnie and I are going to go over what we consider to be kind of the positives, and then we'll kind of play devil's advocate, and we'll talk about, you know, some of the maybe the cons, which we may not necessarily agree with. But I want to make sure to give, you know, both sides of you know, of the argument, because it's not perfect. You know, no era of comics is perfect, and I recognize, at least for me, that I'm looking back at it a little bit with rose colored glasses just because of, you know, the time period of my life that it occurred in. So in your mind, Donnie, what are some of the biggest positives of the Triangle era?
Well, like I say, it's a very, I mean, it's such a serialized storyline that it's, that's very satisfying as a reader. Now, when I was reading these initially, Superman was the only storyline I was following, you know, so since then I've gone back and I quite like what was going on in comics generally, but it was the same thing. I had to go back and find out, you know, about the sort of the Bwahaha Justice League and, you know, the Ray Fogle Batman and that sort of era. Really, I was just kind of a Superman fan only. So so I didn't realize that other comics weren't like this, that they weren't as linked and they weren't as tight of a storyline. But it was very satisfying as a reader to have, you know, one little thing sort of pop up in an issue and you go, oh, that was strange. And then it goes away. And then about three issues later, that pops back up. And, you know, it was very satisfying to see these little breadcrumbs that would then turn into a full storyline. And then that would go away, but then it would refer to something else. And just the attention to detail, it really felt like a cohesive world. And I mean, you look at the films that are out now and how everything's about, you know, world building and these little Easter eggs that point to other things. And that was really kind of the method of storytelling. Also, just, I really liked the art. I really liked, they were all pretty consistent, fairly realistic, cartoony art. The tone was very similar book to book. So, I mean, it's a very, I guess we'll get into this later about the behind the scenes stuff of the creative teams, but it's a very humble, sort of job to take on, knowing you're not going to be able to finish your own storyline. You know, knowing it's a very egoless, you sort of have to be egoless to be like, okay, for the greater good of this storyline, I'm going to pass it off to this person and hope that, you know, they do it justice. So that consistency of quality from book to book was it wouldn't have worked otherwise. So.
Yeah. And I think another thing that a lot of people, well, I've actually heard it both ways. I've heard some people that love it and some people that dislike this fact about the Triangle era. So it's not like you had extra pages during this era, but you did have, because the stories were so tightly, you know, joined together from issue to issue across titles, and because it came out basically weekly, you didn't have to spend much time, if any, doing any kind of recap or catching readers up, which, you know, nowadays it comics don't do that anywhere near as much. I mean, in the 80s, sometimes you'd get like, you know, if any of you listeners listen to our Secret Wars, Saturday Secret Wars recaps, you'll know, like in the original Marvel superhero Secret Wars, they would devote a whole page, if not a page and a half, to recapping what happened in the series prior to that point, right? And nowadays, Marvel does, you know, a couple paragraphs maybe on the inside cover. DC tends to stay away from them, except for the recent Bendis Superman books where they dedicate a page to it.
Which is kind of controversial, as you mentioned on your show.
But the fact that these issues were coming out, you know, the next part of the story was coming out just a week after, readers really kind of remember what was going on. You know, only a week's gone by. Of course, you remember. So, it wasn't that they had extra space because they had extra pages. It was more like a little more space because you didn't have to worry about the recap. And with that extra space, I think is a big part of the reason that this era of Superman had probably the biggest supporting cast of any era of Superman, because you had just a little bit more room. Just maybe it was a few panels, but just enough that over time, over this long period of time, this 10, 11 years, you did have time to build a supporting cast that was larger. You know, you got Lucy Lane, Lois Lane's sister. You got Ron Troop, another one of the reporters at the Daily Planet. You got, you know, some Cat Grant stuff, and by introducing these characters and giving them a little bit of screen time, to Don's point earlier, it was little breadcrumbs that eventually could lead to a bigger story. Oh, here's Cat Grant's son being kidnapped by a toy man. Here's Ron Troop getting himself into trouble while pursuing a story, right? And you felt like by being introduced to these characters who started off, you know, very, very small, eventually that it was a payoff that you were reading and paying attention and getting to know these other characters, because eventually the spotlight would swing all the way over and they would get kind of their time in the sun, or their time on center stage, so to speak. So, again, I do recognize that there are some people don't like that about the the era that there was such a large cast, because they're like, well, I'm buying these books because I like Superman. I want to see Superman. I want to see Clark. I want to see Lois. I don't really care about all these other, you know, characters. But
I'm jumping ahead of it. That is one of the criticisms for sure. And we'll get to that, I guess. But it does remind me. You make such a good point about the supporting cast, because it also reminds me of. It reminds me of The Simpsons a little bit, where there's so many characters, and they can start off as caricatures of characters, of where it's like, okay, Cat Grant is sort of the sex pot, and Bibbo is the town drunk. But by the end of it, you end up seeing, no, Cat Grant's a real fully fleshed out person with, you know, regrets and does the right thing. And Bibbo ends up being one of the most profound characters. He's a real favorite of ours on the blog, obviously. Where he ends up being quite a profound, emotional character, when he was just started off as sort of a riff on Popeye or something, you know? So that is an advantage for sure of having such a large cast that, you sort of get to them eventually, you know, with this many issues to tell a story with.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. I've never heard anybody compare Superman to The Simpsons before, but that is spot on. And I would challenge anybody to tell me that the world of The Simpsons isn't a richer place because of all these characters. You know, The Simpsons have been around for so long now. We've been introduced to all these different characters, and it's made for a very rich world. And the other thing it's done when you think about The Simpsons is allow all these different guest stars to come on and voice them. So it's definitely a richer world for it. And I would argue that you could say the same thing about the Triangle era. But again, I do recognize that, yeah, if you are looking for very Superman-centric storylines, there are times where the spotlight does swing away from him a bit. But I just take it as this is the story of Superman. These are his friends. These are his colleagues. They're part of the family. They're part of the story. Some other positives for me is the fact that you didn't have to – and I already talked about this. You didn't have to wait – very long before the next part of the story. And also the fact that it did foster a feeling in the Superman office of working together, right? Like Don said earlier, you couldn't really have an ego. It was, I don't think that anybody over there in the office at the time, from Mike Carlin, who's the Superman editor and who I give tremendous credit to for making this era what it was, but writers like Louise Simonson and Dan Jurgens, John Bogdanov, who did the art on Man of Steel, like all these people, they were such a huge part of it. And it wasn't like, okay, now I'm telling my story. It was our story. It was all for one. They were really pulling together. And just from the fact that they all were selfless and they all wanted to put out the best Superman story they could, I think that for the most part, this is one of the most consistent eras in terms of quality. The books were so high quality for such a long time, and I really feel like it's because they were all selfless. They all put aside any kind of, you know, personal reward or personal recognition to say, we're going to work together, and, you know, we want to tell the best Superman story that we can. And it that kind of environment, when everybody loves what they're doing and they're all working together and pulling for a common goal, it comes across in the books, not in a way you can necessarily point to any concrete this or that or whatever, but it does come across in the quality of the books and in the tone. You can just tell that everybody's on the same page. Would you agree, Don?
Absolutely. And tone is such a great point, because that is one of the things I love best about this era, is just how wholesome Superman is. This is, you know, put in the context of comics at large, this is the Image era. You know, this is the era of sort of style over substance, and, you know, badass characters and this kind of thing. And Superman is so decent, and his world is so decent, even though he's obviously fighting evil and stuff. There was such a, like you say, the tone was so consistent, but without being homogenized. Like the style was consistent, the quality was certainly consistent, but then each writer and each artist had sort of an area that they would excel at, you know. And part of it was in the title, right? Like Adventures of Superman tended to be more kind of superheroics. Superman tended to be more Superman and the Daily Planet Office. Action was more of the team-up book. You'd see more, if there's a team-up character, they tend to be there. And the writers would have different focuses. And I mean, it would still be one big storyline, but, Roger Stern was just the best at writing Lex Luthor. For whatever reason, he could just write him so well. And Louise Simonson would tend to focus more on the romance between Lois and Clark and typically kind of the maybe the turbulent, more turbulent times and more the bickering, more the kind of Lois's point of view. And there's certain characters that would pop up in certain books more than others. We joke, I mean, we've got a ton of running jokes on our blog, again, because it's so long running. It's the same as the comic, but I really despise the character Jeb Friedman. But again, it's like if you wanted to see that kind of conflict, you wanted to see this sort of Gaston-like character, he tended to be in Man of Steel, whereas Bibbo tended to be more in the Ordway books and on and on, where there was kind of these different, so it's different flavors in this one world, so it wasn't really homogenized as much as it was consistent.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And for me, I don't mind it necessarily. But again, to switch over to kind of the negatives now, one of the complaints I hear other than, yeah, you had all these supporting cast and it wasn't focused enough on Superman. Another one of the complaints I hear about it is, so if you wanted to get the full Superman story, you were kind of forced to buy all the books. And maybe that wasn't in your budget, or you just wanted to collect Action, or you just wanted to collect Adventure. I mean, you could do that, but you did at times – this wasn't always the case, but you did at times feel like – I'm missing out on part of the story. I'm kind of forced to buy, Superman comic every week, and maybe that's not in my budget, or maybe it's just not something I want to do. So I do recognize that. I mean, for me, more right. Superman, better, right? But maybe that's not the case.
Right. I mean, we're talking about this when I live in Canada, so comics were 90 cents, So even as a 12-year-old boy, 90 cents a week, I could probably swing it, Yeah. But whereas today, that'd be like $12 a week or, I mean, that is a hit on the pocketbook. And like you say, what if you didn't like, I mean, the art level was pretty consistent, but they were all different. So, I mean, I had my favorites. I'm sure you had yours. Max and I have, different favorites on our blog. And so sometimes it would be, I mean, to go to the negative, it would be kind of a bummer if it was maybe not your favorite artist covering the end of this story or the culmination of something you were really interested in. So that could be viewed as a drawback.
Yeah, I agree with you. I know that a lot of people, a lot of Superman fans, probably the biggest difference in art style would be somebody like Ordway, whose art is, very detailed and subtle. And then you have John Bogdanov over in Superman Man of Steel with much thicker lines. Things are a little bit more blocky. And if Ordway was just your jam and you didn't like Bogdanov, then you're like, okay, well, if I want to get the story, I'm reading this book and with this art that I don't really care for. So again, for me, it didn't bother me. There wasn't, I had my favorites. Like I think Ordway for me is one of the greatest Superman artists of all time.
Amen.
But I didn't have any problem with any of the rest of the art necessarily. But I understand that there are people that did. But I mean, you're right. To get back to the point about how each of the books did have a little bit of its own kind of flavor, the Man of Steel was kind of the more gritty. A lot of if Superman was going to go to Suicide Slum, it probably happened in Man of Steel. If the story took him there, that was going to happen in the Man of Steel. Just for whatever reason, Louise Simonson really wanted to get at kind of the social issues, social inequality, things like that, and kind of down, more street level, if you can say. Whereas Adventure was more like the cosmic, focusing on, the heroic adventures. As you said, Action with the guest stars would show up there more so. So yeah, every book did have a little bit of its own feel. And I guess I'm kind of going back to the cons here. We're jumping back and forth. But I did find that fascinating because when I was reading it at the time, I didn't notice it that much. It was just, I was just reading Superman. And then years later, reading about different eras and people talking about, it was one continuous story. But if you go back and look at it, there did tend to be certain eras of or certain aspects of this era of Superman that showed up in certain books, right? Like Suicide Slum, you're going to see that in more so in Man of Steel. Cadmus, you're probably going to see that more in Adventure. Daily Planet, you're going to see more in Superman. Guest Stars, you're going to see more in Action. So, and Luthor as well. So, yeah, I never noticed that at the time. And that's a credit to the writers doing it so seamlessly from, you know, series to series, but also being able to focus on their one particular era.
Yeah, and having their own interest, you know, like where it's right. This is what they're interested in, and that's what they want to represent.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think. I mean, again, this is my era. I'm trying to think of what other comic. So we touched on what I hear, you know, and again, this is a lot of what I hear other people complaining about. It's too many books. I'm forced to get them all. Too many cast members. The supporting cast is too big. I don't, you know, I whatever. I can't afford to buy them all, or I'm forced into buying them all. What are some of the other negatives that you hear?
Well, yeah, the supporting cast thing is a big one. And also there is a tendency, even from writers that I love, like Jerry Ordway, to almost write around Superman. Like if you read a John Byrne Superman or even a Dan Jurgens Superman comic, you'd get his thought bubbles. You'd sort of get what he's thinking more of the time. Whereas sometimes they'd almost write around him, where you'd get, I mean, it's a very typical writing style. I mean, from all the way from Sherlock Holmes up to now, with that's why they keep Robin around, is that you know, you could observe Batman better than being in his head. But sometimes I miss that. Sometimes I miss knowing what Superman is thinking. And then the other one that bothered me a little bit with the era, and it happens kind of over and over with Superman, not just in comics, but, you know, on the animated series and these kind of things. And it's very difficult to talk about because obviously I love Jack Kirby, but I felt like the Kirbyverse stuff can almost take over Superman in a way, like where it's as soon as Darkseid and his kind of stuff shows up in cartoons, that's kind of going to be the focus of Superman for a while. And obviously there's a lot more villains than that. It's a richer, you know, tapestry than that. And I think that started to happen a little bit with Superman, where it was so much about Cadmus, so much about where you're seeing, you know, Guardian and Double X and the Newsboy Legion and the Forever People and on and on and on, where it would kind of go down that rabbit hole of Kirby stuff, which is honoring and tributing, you know, eras from the past, from the Jimmy Olsen, his own comic in the 70s and that cool stuff. But in a way it would almost, I was like, get back to Daily Planet. I want to see what's going on with, you know, News Time and, you know, more of the kind of mundane everyday adventures. So sometimes I do feel like they would overserve the legacy of Jack Kirby in these comics to its own detriment, which I know that's touchy. But for me, sometimes it would be a bit much.
Yeah, I do hear that. You know, I think I mentioned that earlier. Not enough Superman in the Superman books. And again, it goes a little bit to supporting cast. But also, it does remind me of one other negative that I hear sometimes. And that's the fact that these writers, because they were kind of beholden to the overall driving momentum and backbone of the Superman story they were trying to tell, they didn't necessarily have as much freedom to do the things that they might have wanted to do if the books weren't so tightly tied together with continuity. And my answer for that is always, well, they could have gone and written a different book. I think, you know, I've gone to panels at San Diego Comic-Con and other shows where three or four writers get together. I think the 75th anniversary of Superman a few years ago at San Diego had almost everybody was there. Jerry Ordway was there. Mike Carlin was there. Dan Jurgens was there on that panel. Paul Levitz, who was the editor-in-chief at the time, was there. Who am I forgetting? Louise Simonson was there. And it was great to hear them all like reminisce, and they were just up there like telling jokes with each other and laughing, and they seemed to all be enjoying each other's company so much. And I can imagine that probably their weekly meetings that they had talking about how the overall story was going were much like that, with them just enjoying working together. So I understand that complaint when people say, well, the writers probably didn't get as much freedom as they wanted to do, and they may have wanted to do things differently. But again, I think they were all happy to be there, and I think they all enjoyed their time. I'm pretty sure they all said that they did on that panel. So I don't necessarily see that as a negative. Again, I understand, and it is true to some extent, but I think the good far outweighed the bad when you look at that aspect of it. What do you think?
I agree. And I mean, it's weird because I'm sort of protective of this era. It's my favorite era of comics too. And I still think they're the best. I still, you know, hold these artists up as the best artists of their generation and these writers as well. But a complaint I do hear is that it being an egoless, way of storytelling, way of artistry, that it closed them off, closed the Superman books off from maybe some talent that was pretty big in the era. Which, you know, I'm sensitive and I'm protective of these artists and I go, well, there's no one else I even want, but it is fun to think about what a Mark Waid Superman would be like, or, I mean, obviously we've seen them since, but you know, there's artists and writers, from the time, who probably were more of a name writer or name artist that didn't work on Superman, perhaps because they didn't want, to have their story finished by, you know, another party, or they wanted to, you know, really do their own bold storytelling, which I imagine is why the Triangle Era ended, you know, like, was because they just, it was tougher and tougher to get people who just consistently wanted to tell this long of a storyline.
Yeah. And I think another reason it ended, or at least this is what I've heard, is that, so being that these Superman titles were all so closely knit together, it made it hard to incorporate other aspects of the DC universe. Like, if you wanted to do a crossover, you know, a line wide crossover, which they did, or if you wanted to just have it crossover with, you know, one other corner, like Batman, Superman, those things had to be planned out much further in advance than if the Superman corner of the universe weren't so tightly tied together, right? Like, if you wanted Batman to show up in a Superman book, it had to either be in two Superman books. If it was, you know, like a four part story, you know, it's going to show up in Batman Detective and then maybe Action and Adventure. You couldn't have it be Batman, just shows up in two consecutive issues of Action. It wouldn't make sense, right? Because you would have read three other Superman books in between. It'd be like, okay, he's over here working with Batman in the midst of solving this crime or whatever. And then he goes off and does something else for three issues. And now he comes back and it's this, you know, the same knight he originally teamed up with. It made things like that logistically kind of tough.
It's true, especially as events became more important, right, to sales.
Yeah, exactly. Because really, when you think about it, the Superman corner was a big event. You know, it was planning out storyline over multiple titles, which is kind of what, you know, event is, you know, a big crossover event. It's planning out a story over multiple titles. So really, you're looking at already having a big crossover event within the Superman books and then having to coordinate that with another line wide event. It made things tough. So that was another part of the reason that, that I think the Triangle Era came to an end, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Like, and you know, again, getting back to negatives, like, around, you know, 96, 97, the Superman books weren't, I don't think they're quite as good as they once were, but then you had Grant Morrison writing JLA, which was, you know, so exciting and so fresh. And then right in the middle of his JLA storyline, you get Electric Boogaloo Superman, yep, dumped into it, you know? And yep. So I still kind of regret, I wonder, you know, what, I mean, obviously we've seen what Grant Morrison would do with Superman in other books, but that JLA run was so great and it would have been, it just really, I mean, as much as I never liked the Electric Boogaloo period, but it's a real loss when you had Grant Morrison's JLA having to deal with it too.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that too. I need to ask next time I run into like Dan Didio or Grant himself. I need to ask. Dan does such a great imitation of Grant. I mean, not that Didio was there at the time, but he may know the answer to that. Well, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about some of the storylines of note during the Triangle Era. We're clearly not going to touch on them all. I literally pulled 9 storylines out of the top of my head. Like, when I'm thinking about this era of Superman, what are the storylines that jump out at me? And really we could go on, you know, on and on and on. And I'll point to the Superman blog, the Superman 86 to 99 blog again. Just because they do cover like so much more than, you know, we do or can in our time here today. But, I didn't rank them in order necessarily, but again, you know, I was pulling them off the top of my head. So probably some of the ones at the top were probably a little, I would argue that the one at the top is probably the most impactful and important, and the biggest storyline, because it's the one that popped in my head immediately. But again, no particular order. But Death of Superman, this happened during the Triangle Era, and I think that the the structure of the Superman office and the structure of the way they were telling the story at the time so enhanced this story because, again, it was coming out weekly. You didn't have to wait, you know, a month. So it really kept the momentum going. And, you know, Death of Superman, which was Superman 75, there were lines around the block at a lot of comics shops. People buying this book, it was showing up on the 6 o'clock news. I mean, it was a big, big deal. And I loved it. It was, for me, it was emotionally impactful. It was a great story. To this day, I'm still not a big fan of Doomsday. He seems to me a very two-dimensional villain, but man, I was still was riveted at the time. And I think it was a really, really impactful story. And the only other thing that I'll mention, the Superman creative teams told this story at that panel at San Diego a few years ago. And I think a lot of people know, but maybe some don't. So the thing was that the big event that was actually being planned was the marriage of Superman and Lois, finally. And they wanted it to coincide with the Lois and Clark TV show. They were supposed to get married there, right? Well, then at the last minute, you know, and again, you're planning these things out way in advance for the Superman creative teams. At the last minute, the show decided that they didn't want to get them married off just yet. They wanted to have them break up and have, you know, space to tell more stories with the drama of will they, won't they, rocky relationship kind of stuff. And the Superman creative team on the comic side, they were kind of stuck, right? They're like, what do we do now? What are we going to do? We had this whole wedding thing planned and, you know, all the lead up to it or whatever. And apparently whenever they would get stuck at a point like this, somebody would invariably call out, let's kill him. Jokingly, right? Like, how can you kill Superman? He's the first of all the superheroes. You can't. And Mike Carlin said, you know, that, well, what are we going to do? We're stuck now. We can't marry him off just yet. We've got to find some time to, you know, who knows how long it'll be to fill in. And somebody, you know, inevitably yelled out, let's kill him. And Mike was like, for the first time, he sat back and said, and this is Mike Carlin, sat back and said, you know what? Maybe it's time. Like, how would that work? Like, I'm not just going to dismiss that comment as somebody's, you know, wisecrack, which is what it was. He's like, okay, if we were to do that, how would we do it? And that's so crazy to me that it started as a lark, right? And it ended up being probably what's the most famous storyline of Superman of all time. And for me, you know, the lead up and him being killed and then so impactful. And then really the following storyline, which we'll talk about next, that really showed why there's only one Superman and what it is about him that's so amazing. So yeah, for me, that's the granddaddy of storylines in this era. What do you think, Don?
Absolutely. And it's so, it came at such an interesting time symbolically, like we mentioned about Image Comics and about the changing tone of the industry in that era. And so it took on this bigger meaning of this character who was so consistent and forthright and decent, you know, in such a, I mean, he's an 80-year-old, or I guess 80-year-old now, but at the time he was about a 60-year-old character. To kill him in that era took on this really a much more profound meaning in the industry. And for me as a reader who, you know, I read it all the way through, it's sort of like when your baseball team makes the playoffs and then, you know, the national broadcasters are all paying attention to your guys. And, you know, you're sort of seeing them with fresh eyes, or at least the rest of baseball is, because that's what it felt like for me, was that all of a sudden everyone is focusing on this comic and seeing what I love about it, seeing, you know, the storytelling and the emotion and the supporting cast and the, you know, the great artists and writers, because everyone flocked to the book. And they stayed in large part, right? Like the sales went up and they kind of stayed up, because people really fell in love with the way they told stories. So, it was a big idea, but the execution made it even bigger.
I want to ask you, what's your opinion on Doomsday as a character?
Same thing. I think he's sort of one of these characters where less is more. I think you should sort of like have him burn it at all. Obviously, he was, you know, this force of nature and something new. And I did appreciate that because, if Lex killed him or Brainiac killed him or someone like that, it would just kind of be, I don't know, it would change that character forever.
Right.
So then having it be this new sort of X factor thing where it's like, we know nothing about this guy, made it seem more possible. But I'll be honest with you, like it's sort of embarrassing, but I was 12 when these issues came out. I had nightmares about Doomsday. I would dream about Doomsday, coming to my school and having him get away and stuff. Because he was that terrifying to me, this notion of something that was tough enough to, flatten the Justice League. And that only Superman could take him down. And so obviously each time Doomsday has returned, they've kind of diminished that character because he's just so extraordinarily powerful and so single dimension, so one dimensional, there's not a lot more we can do with him. Though I did actually like the Hunter Prey when they brought him back. Maybe we're going to get into that later, but I thought that was pretty good. But then once they got into, the Doomsday Wars and this kind of nonsense, and it got pretty a little much, but yeah, in general, I sort of have a love hate with Doomsday because I love that storyline, but I hate him because he killed Superman, and I hate it that he kind of jumped the line in terms of being Superman's big bad that they return to so often.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think with Doomsday, less is more. As much as I have a lot of problems with the changed up origin in the Batman versus Superman movie, I did feel that he was on screen just the right amount of time. When you look at it, he's really not on screen very often, And to me, it's like, okay, he manifests himself. He's a giant monster. He's unthinking. He's, like you said, a force of nature. And I think it worked perfectly, in that context. In the comic, just based on the fact that you tell stories differently because it's a different medium, he kind of did tend to linger even in this storyline a little more. So he was like a part of my reality of that time for so much longer because it is a serialized storytelling through comics where it's lasting much longer period of time. Whereas I think in the movie he's on screen for like 10 minutes, right? So yeah. I think he works better like as a villain in the kind of the motion picture medium than he does in the comic, because again, you get less and less is more for Doomsday.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned the other storyline that's really stands out to me. And the rest all I would say are on kind of a step down the lower tier. And it's the Reign of Superman, which is kind of tells the return, right? So Superman was killed and they didn't bring him back right away. They actually brought four different Supermen, and you can actually think of them as kind of different aspects of his personality, right? So we had a new Superboy, the Metropolis Kid, be kind of his nickname. We had the Cyborg Superman, who, again, borrowing it, kind of a nickname for Superman, the Man of Tomorrow. You had who turned out to be the Eradicator or Last Son of Krypton kind of Superman. And then you had the Man of Steel, John Henry Irons, who was almost think of as kind of like an Iron Man in a way without as many fancy gadgets. So you had these four different characters that all kind of showed up after Superman was killed, and they were all active in Metropolis, and they were all trying to kind of fill that void, fill that role. And I remember at the time there was so much speculation. Everybody was thinking, okay, which one is actually the real Superman? Like, are we going to find out that the cyborg Superman that, basically the damaged parts of Superman's body were cut away and replaced with, technology. And this is now Superman, or, the Last Son of Krypton Superman is actually the real Superman. And he seems emotionless and unfeeling because, basically he has died. His soul is gone. And now it's just this, this solar battery kind of, unfeeling, unemotional Superman. Is it the Metropolis Kid? Is it Superboy? Where Superman's been cloned, and that's why he's much younger because he hasn't matured all the way. Or is it, and I kind of think those, I think the Cyborg and Superboy were the two that I think people guessed the most that that was actually Superman. I think.
Oh, really?
I think.
Because my money was on The Last Son. Because if you read the story where he, where that character emerges, it does seem, they lead you to believe that that's at least the body.
Right.
You know, that's true. More than the others. So I was thinking, okay, well, he'll be around. He's going to be this Clint Eastwood Superman for a while, and then he'll remember his heart and it'll all be fine. I had no idea that it was going to be none of them, that it was going to be, just and the sleight of hand and the sort of the masterful storytelling of that. Like you say, I know that the death of Superman, and for me it is too, the defining story. But I actually prefer the reign of Superman because it just, there's not a lot of story to the death of Superman, but the return of Superman, a lot goes on, and it's a lot of sleight of hand and it's a lot of storytelling tricks. And they really kind of just showed off. Like it was, I was so proud of the team.
Yeah, it really holds up, actually. I was going to say, so the fourth one, the Man of Steel, John Henry, we kind of knew right away that wasn't just based on how he looked.
Yeah, I felt bad for the writers having to try to make the case. So then they would say, oh, well, he's the spiritual successor. There was some sort of, spiritual walk-in that he had the McCoy with Spock or something.
Yeah.
That he had Superman's soul,
Yeah, but again, to your point, with the sleight of hand, the moving around, I mean, different times, I remember thinking, yeah, it's probably Superboy, but I think at different times I did have my doubts on which one it actually was. And then, of course, it turns out to be none of them, although all those characters continued to be a part of the Superman mythos going forward. Some more than others. And I think Superboy was probably the one that eventually, when Jeff Johns got a hold of him and started going by the name Kal-El, and he was beloved, really, which is interesting because when in the pages of the Superman book that he was in, he's kind of a punk at first.
It's true. You're never more aware of that it's a 90s comic than what Superboy's on the page, for sure. But I mean, now, I don't know, as much as you can be embarrassed about that, I just dig it. I love that 90s look, man. I love the leather jacket. And I mean, part of it is, and we'll touch on it later, but I live in the same city as Tom Grummett, one of the Superman artists, and he designed Superboy. And so I've got this sort of strange mentorship, friendship relationship with Tom. So hearing his stories about how that came together, and obviously I've got a real soft spot for Tom, but yeah, Superboy is just kind of a force unto itself. And I mean, I do a lot of conventions, across Canada and some in the United States. And there's not one where I don't see somebody dressed up like a version of Superboy.
Yeah, he and like I said, he was the one that got his own title spinning out of it. Although I guess Steel did get a title for a little while as well. But yeah, it turns out that it's none of them. None of them could replace the real Superman. And we do get the original back. And I like he had longer hair, which was, again, very much of its time, which was okay for a while. But eventually when it became like a really pronounced like Billy Ray Cyrus mullet –
it's true.
I don't know that it bothered me that much at the time, but if there's one thing when I look back, we should have mentioned this in the cons of the Triangle Era, the mullet. Like when I look back at some of those covers with him with the mullet, I don't necessarily blame Superman or DC Comics or the creative team of Superman. I blame the 90s.
Exactly. When it depended on who was drawing it too, because you look at the Jurgens Superman with long hair and it looked pretty good. He kind of looked like that Kurt Russell, like long hair. But then you'd look at, and I do love him as an artist, but you'd look at Jackson Geese, I'm not sure how you say it. And his was straight up mullet. It was like normal Superman hair and then straight down like curtains.
Yep.
So it was, it looked a little more just kind of greasy, and not literally, but that sort of, I don't know, dirtbag Superman look. So from book to book, it was kind of, whereas then Tom Grummett's was more of like a wild, more Conan-y,
Yeah, I was going to mention that you mentioned Tom Grummett. I think, he didn't. It wasn't as long, if I remember right, when Grummett, and it didn't look as I don't know, as Buffon. Like, for me, Bogdanov, it was almost like a Buffon up front. It was like really puffy on the top above the forehead, and then kind of
it was, yeah, it was major flow, that's for sure.
Yeah, so the mullet, yeah. Well, the next getting away from that particular era, because, you know, one storyline, the death, led right into the rain. I think Time and Time Again was one of the first storylines where I was like, wow, this really kind of shows what you can do with this in this era of Superman by really tying them together. So
I love it so much. What launched that storyline was, it was, you know, the minute he told Lois Lane he was Clark Kent, then he's immediately whisked away. And so it's, you know, what is for Lois Lane, what ends up being, I think, a few days, is months and months and months of story for Superman. Just as he thinks he might be losing the love of his life and doesn't know if he'll, you know, if he'll get back. He doesn't know how long Kryptonians necessarily live. So, I mean, if he's stuck in 1940, you know, but yeah, like you say, just how adaptable the character is, where it's, okay, here's him with the Legion. We love seeing that. Here's him in the Warsaw Ghetto. And just how heavy and how restrained that storytelling was, you know. Just that was an amazing storyline.
Yeah, and again, to the point you just made about how this character works in all these different periods of time, you know, and all, he just works. He's, and how much he still can connect with the people of that time. You know, you put him in anywhere, and thinking about it now, if we look at the Vandal Savage story from Action Comics 1000, where Patrick Gleason was kind of telling, you know, with these different one shots in different periods of time, kind of telling the same story in a way of this character works in all these different. He'll be a hero no matter where you put him throughout human history, which is just great. And one last thing I'll mention about Time and Time Again, it also introduced us to the Linear Men, which eventually Wave Rider and the 2001 storyline and all that stuff. So
I've got this sort of back pocket of all these, you know, sort of storylines I've got in the back of my head that I would love to do if I ever got a chance to write or draw Superman. And one of them, and I think I mentioned on the blog, that I'd love to do would be Time and Time Again, where, like, Back to the Future 2, Superman has to help himself succeed in these, you know, like, where there's all of this other stuff going on. And I mean, it's partially just being a big Back to the Future fan. But that's a storyline I'd love to see, is that he's actually there twice or three times, you know, helping himself succeed. But maybe that's a little too inside baseball.
No, we'd have like a whole army of Superman all showing up to fight Doomsday in Metropolis. So Superman never
exactly. Really, and it would rock and roll. And, you know.
Another storyline, and again, this one was actually pretty popular back in the day, and some of these issues were pretty valuable. It's Panic in the Sky, which was Brainiac taking over War World, and Superman having to gather a bunch of different heroes from Earth to kind of fight off this potential of invasion. And I mean, it had Batman, Guy Gardner, Wonder Woman, Nightwing, Mr. Miracle, Shazam. So it was again, it was a pretty, I mean, even Deathstroke, Superman even.
Yeah, we covered that pretty extensively on the blog, how just what a push DC was giving him at that time. Yep. And how absurd it was that Superman of all people would have this like pedophile assassin heading up his army on the, you know, in War World. But he was a very cool character. He looked awesome. So it was only in retrospect that it seemed weird to me, because I was like, oh man, that guy looks so great, you know.
Yeah, and I remember at the time really liking it. I mean, so, and I've told this story on the podcast before, when I first started buying comics, I tended to go more toward the team books, because you know, 5-year-old head, I was like, well, I'm getting more value for my money because I'm discovering more characters. I'm getting to see more powers because there's more people in it.
Right.
So Panic in the Sky, you know, here I am, I'm buying Superman books, but I'm getting all these other characters. So I think at the time, that's what I enjoyed about it. But when I've gone back and read it before, I didn't enjoy it as much. Second time around, I don't know. I think I don't necessarily find Brainiac to be that compelling of a villain. I think is ultimate. Not that it wasn't a threat that he had taken over War World, but I don't know. I guess as I got older, I just enjoy a little more complexity in my villains. And I don't know that the way Brainiac was written here, there really was that much complexity.
That was maybe the drawback of this era was, I mean, I love Brainiac and I like that this sort of put him on that level of like, he's a character that should be showing up in a Justice League movie. Like he's that level of danger. But him being merely a psychic and not the sort of like, you know, robotic or, intelligent character, was maybe reduced him. Like that was maybe one of the missteps of the Byrne era was having Brainiac be literally, a mentalist, be a Brainiac. Was maybe a missed opportunity because psychic characters just, it doesn't work visually, right? The same way that other characters do. So if you would have had this story with like the Ed Hannigan metallic Brainiac, that would just be they still use the skull ship, right? Because they just couldn't get away from what a cool design that was. The sort of goatee looking, magician looking Brainiac visually left a little to be desired for me. I did love that it was, put Brainiac on that level of like, look, you need this many characters to deal with it. And then, and like you say, bang for your buck to see Superman shoulder to shoulder with, Captain Marvel, one of my all time favorite characters and interacting. Was so cool. And specifically in the storyline, Superman didn't save the day, the Flash did.
Yeah.
So it was pretty pretty again egoless storytelling that it was like even in his own book, it was a team effort, So.
Yeah, and again, getting to see a lot of these really great artists working on these characters too was pretty awesome as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, anytime you put Booster Gold back in the hands of Dan Jurgens, both writing and drawing. I'm in for sure. You mentioned this storyline as not being one of your favorites of the era. I really dug it at the time, and in fact, I have several. It's Superman Blue, right? To put you out of your suspense, Superman Blue, which eventually became Superman Blue and Red. I have here in my studio two of each of the action figures because I had to buy one that I could open and then one that's still like in the, still sealed, if you will. So I have, one of each. So, one Superman Red open, one Superman Blue open, and then both in there. So I know at the time I took the time to go and search these out and buy them. I know at the time I really, really loved it. And I know other people. Jason Inman is a friend who loves this era, this storyline.
So I got to come clean that at the time I didn't love it, similar to you, where you kind of went away from the books and then you came back for the Death of Superman storyline. Same thing happened to me. In Canada, they raised the price of comics from 95 cents to $1.25. So now I'm 14. So that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So then that was part of it. But then they also right away had Superman when he got married was great. But then he almost immediately upon being married, got the electric suit. So I actually stopped buying them kind of in protest, but also kind of because it was more expensive than I wanted it to be. So I wasn't reading them. And then a local comic store I had this big sale in 1999. They had a big sale where all their back issues went on for 25 cents. So guess who picked up every comic they missed, which is me. And then I read them, and as I read them, I went, oh, well, this is great. Because the coolest thing about it was Superman hated it. Superman didn't want to have these powers. He wanted to just like, so having that note of like, I'm not nuts about this. I've got to just do my thing and be Superman. There was actually a lot of charm to those issues and different artists. I mean, Stuart Immonen was probably the best artist of that era. And he drew that electric suit like so well. It was really a pretty cool look. I do remember though, I mean, that one little joke I remember from Justice League, when Grant Morrison was writing it, which was kind of more my focus of reading in those days, was when that new costume debuted in Justice League, Superman walks into the, the watchtower, and then Batman goes, interesting look. And then Superman just offers, well, these are interesting times. And it was kind of this, that even Batman's burning him about his costume. So I like that in universe, he wasn't nuts about it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people were kind of in the same boat as you, right? Like they looked at it as a gimmick. Oh, come on. Why are you ruining Superman? So much of the 90s was about kind of replacement. You know, we got Az-Bats and we, you know, got all these, you know, we got Kyle Rayner, we got Connor Hawk, we got all these new characters replacing the old. And you didn't replace Superman, but he had a completely different look, completely different power set. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, it really was ruining Superman because he's, you know, such an icon. I don't know why anybody ever thought that this would ever stick for any, you know, any period of time. It was just, you know, just a story that had to run its course. So,
they did get pretty gimmick happy, you know, because I think they learned the wrong lessons from the death of Superman and the Nightfall storyline, where it's like, oh, well, we just have to shake things up and then that'll equal sales. And, you know, not necessarily. So,
yeah, but I will admit to probably owning about 8 copies of Superman 123, the glow in the dark. I can't help but whenever I come across the glow in the dark cover, I just buy it, even though I have more than my fair share. So,
yeah, and the other, there were some interesting storyline things too that that they built into it that were pretty cool, like that Clark Kent was truly human. When he wasn't in the suit, you know, that he was much more vulnerable. That's interesting. Plus, they did interesting things like, I think he put on weight, you know, not being Kryptonian anymore. I think he got a little chunkier, you know, which was kind of an interesting little twist too.
Yeah, the other thing I'll mention about Superman Blue, I don't think it lasted as long as people seem to think that it did. I mean, it was just a couple of issues of each of the titles, and then for the Superman Red Blue arc, and you know, and there was the Superman Red Blue special, but then it went into the Millennium Giant story, and that had a few other tie-ins with like Supergirl and Teen Titans, but then by the end of the Millennium Giants arc, then he's back to normal. So it wasn't, I mean, people seem to think it was like this, you know, multi-year storyline that was like, oh, he was Superman Blue, like for all the night, you know, all the second half of the 90s and whatever. It really wasn't that long. But again, being the fact that the way they were telling stories, you know, in the Triangle era, going from, you know, one issue to the next issue in cross titles, it kind of made it seem like longer, right? Like if it was just, you know, 3 or 4 months where he was, you know, Superman Red and Blue in one title, that's only 3 or 4 issues. But the fact that, you know, again, the structure of the Triangle era, you know, you're looking at like 20, 25 issues, which for a normal title, that is a couple of years.
Right.
But in real time, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that long.
Right.
Another storyline that, and this one again, kind of showed that con I was talking about with how tough it was to really have these line wide events and include the Superman books, was Our Worlds at War.
Right.
Because again, they're, you can't just cross it over with one or two of the titles. You've got to cross it over with everything. And for me, Our Worlds at War was not the greatest story. It was the story of this character. I think Imperius Rex was his name, and he was coming over to take over Earth to use it as a staging ground to like destroy the universe or something like that.
Which we've seen. I mean, that's every villain, right? That's Mongol. That's, yeah. You know, I mean, that's every villain.
But it felt, the worst part about Our Worlds at War is it just felt bloated. It just felt like too much. There was a lot of one shots, and it was, again, I think them overdoing the crossover. People love crossovers, so more, you know, if people like small crossovers with this many issues, more is better. It just ended up being like really bloated. But the reason I wanted to include it in storylines of note during this era is just because it did take over everything for a time, and there were other ramifications, including some that have to do with the next storyline that we'll talk about. But yeah, I remember reading at Worlds at War and it probably being about halfway through it and being like, okay, this can be over at any time now. I'm kind of done.
Yeah, absolutely. I this is sort of getting, you know, this is pretty late into the run of the Triangle numbers. And really, to me, this is probably the lowest point. As much as I loved Jeff Loeb's and Ed McGuinness's Superman title, I think that, and you know, I hesitate to even say it because I don't want to, you know, criticize an industry that I hope to sometimes be a part of. But Joe Kelly and Joe Casey were probably the most ill-suited writers for Superman comics. Just of this entire era. Like those were as bad as Superman comics got. Yeah. So, and that's right in the heart of it, you know? So, and like you say, yeah, it was very much like event overkill and just kind of like, okay, well, which characters can we kill? X, Y, Z, you know, and they trotted Doomsday out even, you know, it was very lazy storytelling. The only interesting thing to me about All Worlds at War was, and again, it was tone deaf, in a way that they couldn't predict. So this whole storyline about, you know, oh, it's a worldwide war and Kansas is decimated and blah, blah, blah. Or Topeka, Kansas is decimated. The issue that came in the aftermath of the storyline, it was a Man of Steel issue. I can't remember the number now. It came out on September 12th, yeah. 2001. And the first page is LexCorp Tower, which at that time was two L-shaped towers, were smoking on the first page. So on 9/12, you open this comic on Wednesday morning and you see, smoking towers. And it was just so, they couldn't, it was done 4 months earlier, you know, there was no way they could have predicted that would happen. It showed how trivial these comics can be, where it's like, oh, it's a big world war when there's actual wars and there's actual carnage that can happen. It underscored what a tasteless storyline it was to me.
Yeah.
Very, very worth, that issue's worth a lot now because they did recall it and hold it. So.
Yeah, that it was very unfortunate because, I mean, yeah, the attack happens on a Tuesday. The comic comes out on a Wednesday. It's like there's no way to... I mean, the books are already on their way in a lot of places already had them delivered on the, you know, the day before. So yeah, it was unfortunate. I think DC, yeah, they recalled them all. They apologized. They refunded everybody. I mean, there wasn't really much you could do, but it was just about the most unfortunate timing. I mean, we saw a lot of other entertainment media be like a lot of movies that were, you know, ultra violent and such be pulled before, you know, and their release dates pushed back and everything, but there just wasn't the time for DC to do that. And yeah, it was unfortunate. I'd actually forgotten about that. And I think I want to say it's like Adventures of Superman.
Yes, it was, because it was Mike Waringo.
Yeah,
Drew.
Yeah, that's right.
And you're right. It was Adventures. Yeah.
Yeah. And I did mention, so the next storyline that kind of ties in during that Our World's at War, who's president of the United States? Ah, it's Lex Luthor. Yeah.
Right.
I know a lot of you people are going to go, how could Lex have ever been elected president? Well, you have to understand this is the era Lex, successful businessman, regardless of misdeeds. I mean, we can look at to the president of the U.S. today that's possible.
So there's some echoes for sure.
But the other thing was, what was it called? The No Man's Land storyline in Batman, right? Where Gotham City got devastated and the president and his administration at the time didn't do a good job handling it. And Lex Luthor kind of swooped in and he was kind of the hero for rebuilding Gotham and injecting it with, you know, capital and, you know, new technology and everything. And he was incredibly popular in the DC universe at that time for doing that. I mean, obviously he's still a villain. A lot of the heroes, Batman himself, basically forced Lex out of Gotham. He didn't want him there. He kind of, you know, let him rebuild and took advantage of that. But Lex was very popular, and that he kind of rode that popularity into the White House. So it's an interesting story, but I mean, eventually Superman and Batman in the Superman Batman title eventually take Lex down because he's his own worst enemy in the end. But I wanted to put that storyline in here just because, as Don said, it does have so many echoes with what we're seeing going on right now. And that's crazy. I mean, it was about almost 18 years ago. And I think it was right around 2000. So
yeah. And it was, yeah, very prescient. I mean, and in that world, as we've seen, Lex Luthor would run for president. I mean, he's not the kind of guy who's the power behind the guy. He's very ego-driven, very, and as much as, you know, whatever, everybody's sick of talking about Trump. Trump was very much the model for John Byrne's, you know, mogul Luthor, yeah. You know, like the sort of the branding and the garish decoration and the kind of, even his kind of, chunky look. I think we're all echoes of, you know, where you look at the Roger Stern graphic novel about Luthor, the cover was based on Art of the Deal. You know, if you look at them side by side, it's the same font, it's the same layout. So I mean, as much as, it seems like, you know, people go, well, how would that ever happen? Well, it would happen. He's a billionaire that nobody knows how evil he is. Lex Luthor, I mean. and he's been a big part of these, storylines within that world. So, and it was an interesting, there were interesting stories that came out of it where it's, you know, Superman is such an, you know, representation of America, and what happens when America chooses the other, right? I mean, and we've seen echoes of that with stories like Kingdom Come or different ones where they, Superman is, you know, people choose a different path, and how does the Superman deal with that? You know, there was a really interesting issue that came out of that where Superman fought Uncle Sam, because it was, I think it was Jeff Johns, Ed McGuinness issue. And Uncle Sam is the living embodiment of the spirit of America. And under Luthor, it became very xenophobic. And that's what Uncle Sam was. Uncle Sam started fighting Superman because he was an alien, because he was the foreigner and the other. And then so Superman, through the battle, kind of had to, Uncle Sam found his way again. So as disturbing as it was to see a character like Uncle Sam represented that way, again, it's very interesting to see sort of like what is the spirit of America under a president that represents what would seem to be the, you know, the opposite of the ideals of truth and justice. So, you know, there were interesting stories that I think they might do well to reprint some of that stuff. I know they'd lose half their audience, but it sort of seems more current than ever.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I think it's one of the most successful things that Byrne did was the way he kind of reinvented Luthor. And for me, I mean, being such a huge Superman fan, Luthor will always be such a bad guy to me, which is why starting with the Forever Evil storyline with Jeff Johns trying to, I'm not exactly sure to this day what exactly he's trying to do with Luthor. So I'm glad to see him in the pages of Justice League now, more the Luthor that I know, that I can kind of understand, because him trying to be a hero for a while, it rung so hollow for me. And I think that for me, the story that, not to get too far off topic, but the story that epitomizes the Byrne era Luthor for me is there's an early issue of Superman, I think it's issue 9, where there's a backup story where Luthor goes into a diner that's like 900 miles or something outside of Metropolis, literally in the shadow of this Metropolis 900 miles.
Right. It's the exact midpoint between Metropolis and Gotham something.
There's this diner and Luthor goes in there and plays mind games with one of the waitresses. I won't spoil it for you, but it so perfectly epitomizes who Luthor was and just what makes him a bad guy. Just the cruelty of it, the callousness of this manipulation that he engages in the story. It's superb storytelling, and I think it's only like a 4 or 5 page story, but it is really, really good. I recommend it to anybody if you want to understand Luthor. Go
it is. And to show the reach of the triangle numbers, I think it was like 140 issues later, Jeff Loeb brought back that character. Mm-hmm. When Lex was announced he was running for office, that character comes back and sort of has her say, still in the same uniform, which I felt was maybe a touch unrealistic, but I mean, it was a good visual cue for us longtime readers. But it's like, boy, these storylines really sit in the pot and boil, you know, like they to bring back a character that from one storyline that long ago, it just made me kind of love comics, you know.
Yeah, and the one more storyline we'll touch on. Obviously, this is pretty important. I'm surprised. When I was thinking about it, and it goes to kind of the structure of it, this really should have been a lot higher up the list. Again, they're in no particular order, but the wedding of Lois and Clark. I mentioned previously about how they had to scramble when the plans changed for the Lois and Clark TV show, and they had this, you know, this long storyline planned out. And then ended up doing the death of Superman instead. So Superman and Lois get married. About time for me. I know there are some people, probably Brian Michael Bendis included, who don't want Superman to be married. They want to tell stories of him as a bachelor. Man, I love Superman being married. I love that the character has progressed somewhat. I mean, yeah, he certainly doesn't look like an 80-year-old guy now, but it's nice to see some character growth by getting married and having a son. And this is where it all happened. It wasn't a long storyline. It was Superman, the wedding album, where it kind of got thrown together because, again, the TV show pivoted a lot quicker than they expected and said, yeah, okay, let's go ahead and get him married. And the Superman office, as far as the comics go, was forced to scramble. And so they didn't get a chance to tell the longer story that they had planned. But the Superman wedding album is another one that I buy if it's in good shape. It's this like embossed, like pure white cardstock cover.
Yeah, it looks like a wedding invitation.
Yeah, exactly. And if you ever come across a copy that's been like in a box, a comic box with other comics and not bagged, it really picks up. It gets dirty really easily. Only buy them if they're bagged and boarded in good shape. But I probably have, you know, five or six of those as well. And it's a heartwarming story. It's a cool story because Lois and Clark, Superman and Lois finally get married. I do wish that the editorial office at DC had a little more notice because I would have liked to have seen that storyline. But I think it deserved a little bit longer lead up than it got, but it's still.
Yeah, I think also they really wanted to, because of the nature of the industry with, you know, that previews magazine would always show you, you know, what was happening 4 months in advance. They really wanted to surprise these people. I think that was another part of it, was because they, even in the next issue box before that one, they say like, oh, there's a big issue coming, but they didn't say what it was. Yep. So I think they really wanted to, as much as they were forced to be a surprise, I think they also were like, let's do something that no one's expecting, you know? But there were, there's a few things I did like about it. I agree with you that it sort of snuck up on us because it sort of seemed like it was out of nowhere. But there were a few things I did really well. One negative about it was that that era of writers and artists, it just wasn't the best. So I mean, Ron Frenz, he's a great artist but he wasn't quite at the level of like a Jurgens or a Grummet or an Ordway, you know? So kind of to me, the fact that they had the wedding scene, they brought back Jurgens, they brought back Ordway to draw it, sort of showed that the team at the time was kind of lacking, that it was sort of, you know, as much as it, because it's a big issue, you wanted to bring back everybody like a reunion, the same way Action 1000 did, as many artists as you can. To me, it sort of showed, yeah, look, the monthly book isn't that great right now, but remember what it was like when Jerry Ordway was on it. Those last two pages, it's written by Roger Stern, and it's, you know, and then they have the whole cast of characters are all the parishioners in the church are, Superman creators and artists and family and stuff. It's as good as the comics ever got, you know, but those two pages are pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's Superman and Lois. You can't. I should. Long-time listeners will know this. Well, listeners, you haven't been listening for that long. I don't know if you're aware of that. My wife's name Lois, and it's a total coincidence.
Oh, that's the coolest. That's congratulations. That's wonderful. When I got married, I actually wore a Superman T-shirt. She nixed the costume in the early days, but she didn't say anything about T-shirt. So I wore a Superman T-shirt under my tux, which she didn't know about until we went after the ceremony. We went for photos, and then of course I did the big reveal, which was great until we got our photos back. And then every single photo from the ceremony, there's this little blue at the top of my tux, which we had to Photoshop out, which was not great. To this day, every on Facebook, on our wedding anniversary, I put up that two-page spread that Jurgens and Ordway drew of Lois and Clark kissing, and then the big ghostly Superman above them. You know,
nice.
Super and Lois, and then that's kind of how I mark my anniversary every year because it's I over-identify.
Yeah, my wife will tease me, so he only married me because my name was Lois. No, you're pretty good looking too. So,
well, that's very cool.
All right. Those are the storylines of note that I had listed. Are there any other, Don, that you want to mention as we start to wrap things up here?
The only other one that I, it's probably my favorite, storyline, and it relates is the Crisis of the Crimson Kryptonite, which is the storyline that where Lois and Clark got engaged.
Right.
And to me, first of all, just being it was probably as good as the comics ever got, you know, where the teams were, you know, Jurgens and Breeding were their own team. And, or was it Jurgens and T-Bird in that days? I'm not sure. But anyway, Gerardo was doing the Superman book proper. To me, that was sort of the high watermark of the skill level. Like, I just think the comics never looked better than then. And it was such a great storyline because it showed the reader again, what makes Superman the character we love. It isn't the powers, because he didn't have his powers and he still went out and he faced down Mammoth and he, you know, did all these things and also was still an intrepid reporter and, you know, uncovering these great things and being there for Lois when she was, having a tough time with her family. So it was the most human storyline, and just the most satisfying similarly to when, what you're saying about buying, you know, when you see, Superman the 123 or the wedding issue, whenever I see Superman number 50, you know, just on a shelf somewhere, I just always have to buy it because it's just such a satisfying issue. You know, not just the engagement, but also just the scene of, you know, Superman getting his powers back and this newspaper reporter or a newspaper salesman saying like, oh, you get used to these gusts of wind, you know, and it was just very satisfying. And then on a personal level, way back in the day when I was just a kid, I wrote, when Superman died, I wrote the DC, I wrote Jerry Ordway. I wrote and drew a comic saying how they should bring him back, how I thought they should bring him back. And I sent it to Jerry Ordway and he sent me back, a letter and, a handwritten letter and the original artwork and printing proof to Superman number 49, which was the launch of that, Crimson Kryptonite storyline. And very encouraging and was very, very cool to me about my art. And so for that reason alone, I'll always remember that that storyline.
What I loved about it, well, a couple things. First of all, that it's the Crisis Crimson Kryptonite, so very alliterative, but they're all K's. They're not C's, right? Like Kryptonite exactly. Already a K, but you got Crisis and Crimson with K's. And the other thing was that cover of Action, I think it was 656 or 659, where he has like the Superman armor. He doesn't have
the exosuit.
Yeah, he's got the literally the Man of Steel suit. So yeah, that's an image that always sticks with me. So, Don, I really want to thank you for joining me. We'd love to have you back on for Superman Sundays anytime you're available. Do you want to give your website? So if any of our listeners want to check out
my website where you can find everything is donsparrow.com, donsparrow.com. My webcomic is Don't Know Maybe So, .wordpress. And then of course the Superman blog, you can find me on there.
Yeah. And I'll put links to those sites in the show notes. So all your listeners can go and click and find Don's work and the blog and the webcomic. So again, we want to thank everybody for joining us. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. All past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three places are great spots to find out when we release new episodes as well as follow our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for joining me and Don.
And thanks so much. Yeah,
it was great.
This is lots of fun.
So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.